Welcome, everyone. My name is Mel Peel, P-I-E-H-L, and I'm here on the teaching staff of Holden Village. This is my second visit to Holden. The first one was about 20 years ago. So it's really a delight to be back here and to be involved in the life of this absolutely unique community, and a very special privilege to be offering some sessions here during this week. My topic is going to be Catholic social thought, and so I'm going to be doing some different variations on that through the week. But for this first session, I thought it would be useful, since we're kind of approaching Catholic tradition and so on, to do one session just on Catholicism. And I know that's hopelessly presumptuous to do all of Catholicism in 1 hour, but we'll try it here. We're Lutherans. We'll sin boldly in this regard, so we're going to go ahead and do that. I am a professor of humanities and history at Valparaiso University in Northwest Indiana, a Lutheran university. I'm a lifelong Lutheran, but I have been for many years. I'm an American historian, actually, by background and training. So I do American history primarily, but other kinds of humanities and history and literature. But early on, I began working on the history of American Catholicism. So for a long time, I was sort of the token Lutheran in Catholic circles and Catholic studies. So I've hung around Catholics an awful lot in many respects, and cherish many of those relationships. But I think it's I am Lutheran by background and training. I've been assuming perhaps that's also presumptuous to think that most people here are Lutheran. Is that right? Probably not. How many
Catholics?
Oh, good. Okay, Presbyterian. Okay, it's a greater mix. Okay, good. That's great. That's excellent. And the Catholics can keep me on the straight.
Former Catholic.
Former Catholic. Yeah. Right. I am a historian, so I'm going to approach some of this historically, and I know people here will be very interested, in more recent developments in the church and Catholicism, and I think I'll try to get to that fairly readily, but I do think it's useful to have a kind of background and perspective on this. And so if you don't mind, I'm going to sit down and then just kind of talk through some things here and maybe stop after a couple of the major outline points and see if there are any comments and questions, and then hopefully at the end we'll have plenty of time for discussion, conversation, question, because I think that's one of the most valuable things about this. When someone said former Catholic, maybe that's a good perspective to begin, because the point at which we begin thinking about a distinctly Catholic church as opposed to or distinct from Protestantism is, of course, linked to the Protestant Reformation in beginning in 1517. Actually, it's not quite right to say that there was one single unified church before the Reformation, because there had been the major split between the Eastern Orthodox churches and the Western Church, which was about 1000 AD. The ancient historic Eastern churches that were the other parallels to Rome. And the history of Eastern Orthodoxy, the churches that go under that category, come from those, especially the Patriarch of Constantinople, or today's Istanbul, and then, of course, into Russia and so on. But the Western Church, the Roman Church, the Church of Rome, was united, essentially. There were other movements and so on, until the Reformation. And so I think it's very useful for Lutherans, certainly, but for everyone to think about the fact that that was the universal church. And that event, the Reformation, is the beginning of the issues that have gone on ever since. And for a long time, I think most Lutherans would know, and I think most Catholics would know, that Martin Luther himself and Philip Melanchthon, his closest associates, originally thought of themselves very much as a reforming movement within the church universal, the church Catholic. The intention was that there were deep problems in the church, both practical problems, but then also they understood doctrinal issues, the core doctrinal questions, and they, in a sense, were saying there's a distilled essence of Catholicism that has been lost, and we insist on that as the center of the church. And of course, as late as 1520, when Martin Luther wrote Christian Liberty, which is one of his great documents, he dedicated it to the Pope. And the idea was sort of, dear Pope Leo, some of your minions have gotten out of hand. They're doing things less than the way they should. They're teaching false things. Would you please join me in helping us clean up the operation and make the church a better operation? Well, long story short, the Pope didn't take that kindly. And of course, eventually, Luther was excommunicated, 1521. And then still for a long time, though, even when the Augsburg Confession, 1530, which is kind of the foundational doctrine, foundational document of a separate, quote, Lutheran church, it begins by saying, we are Catholics. We are part of the Church Universal. We are offering this document as a statement of our principles in hopes that the church will stay forever unified, and so on. That's the whole first section of it. Again, no emphasis on no intention to start a separate church. They wanted the one church to remain unified. But of course, finally, that failed. And where the, you know, when you want to talk about Catholicism, beginning in the Council of Trent, which was finally the action of the parts of the church that hadn't gone with Luther, and then later the other Protestants, Calvin and the others, they sort of rallied their forces in the Council of Trent, which lasted 17 years. And that was, in many respects, you just think about the fact, when I suppose if you have a big split in a family and parts of it break away and are telling you that you're, you know, totally wrong, that the foundations of your family have gone off key, the ones that remain are in this kind of, I'll call it a kind of defensive aggressive posture. That is, on the one hand, they want to say very firmly now that the people who are trying to compromise and so on are wrong. We have the truth. These people, this entire set of developments is heretical. And furthermore, we want to sort of rally the forces and show that this is the true Church of Jesus Christ on earth, the Church Universal, and so on. So from the Council of Trent develops an entire set of policies and issues and sort of stances toward the world that became deeply ingrained in the Catholic Church for really nearly four centuries. Of course, to say this, at least this is oversimplifying, but that's basically the case. And just to give you some sense of those, they did, for example, refine the dogma of no salvation outside the church. So there's this emphasis upon belonging to the one true Catholic Church is the only means to salvation. The church is a perfect society. It is, you know, Christ's own creation. The Pope is the vicar of Christ on earth. And the church is, in its essential teachings and doctrines, absolutely correct on all matters of faith and morals. So what had earlier been some sort of looseness and ambiguity in the medieval church, and there were a variety of movements and so on, is sort of toughened up. Many of the doctrines, for example, of understanding of the Eucharist and the sacraments and the practices of Christian life are given a new kind of firm and dogmatic form. What you have to do to be a good Catholic, how that's going to operate, how the church system's going to operate is all defined in very strong and firm terms, and to some degree, quite overtly anti-Protestant terms. So you can always go through those documents and say, every point that's being reinforced is to say, and by the way, we're not Protestant. You also have new religious orders, and many of the things, the term that's used here is counter-reformation. Many Catholics prefer to say Catholic Reformation. The Catholic Church did undergo then a great transformation of many of the abuses and things that had been pointed out by everyone besides Luther before the Reformation. And so many of the kinds of corruption and overt misbehaviors that existed were sort of attacked. And you had new religious orders, the most visible of one, which was the Jesuits. that came out of St. Ignatius Loyola of Spain, who was a former soldier of Spain, a kind of brilliant man, religious genius in many respects. And so the Jesuits then became sort of the shock troops of the Catholic Reformation. And then you had a lot of other religious orders being formed in that period following that. And the religious orders, in many ways, became the sort of reforming and transforming movement within the Catholic Church, both male and female religious orders. Of course, the gender hierarchy and difference was still there, but the women's orders also taking on great importance. And there was a kind of, by the way, sort of a Spanish influence in the whole church, the way it got defined. You know, the Germans are gone, the Swedes are gone, the English are gone a little later, so we've still got the Spanish and the Italians. And so that became kind of the focus of the church there. And then just a couple of more, an emphasis new on the idea that the church never changes. The church is the objective representation of universal truth. And so while these Protestants can't ever agree among themselves, the usual distinctions between objective truth and the inherent subjectivity, privatism, individualism of Protestantism, okay? And one of the things that the Catholic writer said at the time of the Reformation was, you watch this. Once the heretics break off, they won't stay united, because by nature, they're each pursuing their own idea, they're reading their own scripture, their own way. So instead of one true church and one heretical church, guess what? There's going to be 40 heretical churches. And on that score, you know, they had something there. I mean, you know, the Lutherans were still Lutherans over five centuries nearly, but, you know, Protestantism had a kind of fragmenting quality, as has always had that, and that's, again, to traditionalist Catholics, that's proof, again, of what's what and who's what. So that was another one. The emphasis on the idea of the apostolic succession. I don't know how many people are aware of this. This is a kind of central teaching of the church, of the Catholic Church, that the bishops of the church stand in direct succession to the apostles and St. Peter. And the way this is understood is that, at, you know, in the text in the New Testament, where Jesus says, "Thou art Peter, and the rock, you know, you are rocky, and on this rock I will build my church," because Peter means rock in Aramaic. So you are rocky, and on this rock I will build my church. Peter is the successor of the first, in effect, the first pope. The other apostles are the bishops, and that in a direct line of succession, ever since, when that is handed down, that is where the authority of Christ and the church lies, in the bishops of the church, that is passed on directly to every bishop of the Catholic Church. So that emphasis upon the foundation of authority lying in the direct succession from the apostles down through the church was sort of re-emphasized. It was always there. Interestingly enough, for some who may know this, in some cases in the Scandinavian country, some of the bishops went over to the Reformation. And so, like, the Swedish Lutheran Church still have the apostolic succession. They still understand that, even though, of course, the Roman Church doesn't recognize that. And the same thing in England, where of course all the bishops went over when the English church became Protestant. And so they still understand that doctrine the same way. But in Germany, not one single bishop went with the Reformation. So that the church had to organize itself on a different basis. Okay, maybe that's enough on the...
May I ask a question?
Sure, yeah, maybe I'll stop here. And any quick questions, sure.
But... So Roman Catholicism actually holds that there is an unbroken line despite the time when there were two popes and two different locations.
Yes. Those kinds of things are, you know, momentary, difficulties, but yet somehow through those the times when, for example, there were three competing popes and so on, but still the true apostolic succession went through that. Right. Yes, there's always been held. And by the way, there's also very much the notion, and you should say this, that it's not that, you know, individual Catholics or even Catholic bishops or other people can't go astray, make horrible errors, and so on, but that the essential church is always preserved in its essence by this guarantee, this promise of Christ in the church. One more thing I might just mention is that one of the traditional points, of course, on authority between the Protestants and the Catholics was church and Bible, okay? And if you were a good Catholic arguer in the old days, now, we'll get to the ecumenical movement here later, but in the old days you'd say, because the Protestants say, Scripture alone, right? Isn't that a Reformation slogan? Yeah. Sola Scriptura. The traditional Catholic response was, guess who created the Scriptures? The Church. The Church decided what writings would become the Scripture. So it's a Protestant error to go to the Bible because the Bible is a product of the Church. So it's the Church that determines, in fact, what's in the Bible in the first place, and secondly, that guarantees that it's interpreted correctly. Now, there are Protestant responses to that, to say the least, but that's the traditional understanding, yeah.
I know Peter's the first pope. Is there a historically known second pope?
Yes, and of course, again, you have to distinguish between what historically, really, we don't know much about this. But yes, I mean, if you open up a traditional, you know, account, there's a second pope and a third and so on, right on through, yes. So the understanding, there's a name attached to it. Right. Now, many historians think that this was done sometime in about the 3rd century when they went back and said, okay, that guy must have been the pope, and so on. So and again, I'm not stepping out of line. Many Catholic historians would say that as well. But yes, in the understanding, and by the way, the pope is only was the bishop of Rome, okay? So you can't read back, even into the Reformation era, necessarily our understandings of the papacy. The Bishop of Rome was one of the historic 5 ancient churches that came out of the ancient world. It's just that over time, he became the first among equals, and all the other bishops understood themselves. The definition, actually, the official definition of a Catholic is a person who is in full communion with a bishop in full communion with the Bishop of Rome. If you want to know if you're really a Catholic, you're in full communion with a bishop who is in full communion with the Bishop of Rome. That's the way it's understood. Yeah?
How did the Jesuits make some reformation from the bottom?
Yeah.
Bottom up rather than so
top down? I wouldn't say so much bottom up. The usual phrase is they were the shock troops of the Counter-Reformation. They defined themselves, I hope this doesn't offend anyone, as sort of the Pope's Marines. Okay, they were going to be the people who would really take the lead. So they weren't exactly, this wasn't exactly something swelling up from the bottom, but it was very, you really trained yourself. The usual training to become a Jesuit, 17 years of rigorous, you know, learning every language imaginable, study, prayer, going through spiritual exercises of Saint Ignatius, which are really quite something. So that's the way they went about it traditionally.
Protestants in the Reformation took advantage of the praying press.
Sure, right.
Put in all kinds of material,
right,
including Bible and local language.
Right.
Did the Catholics also take advantage of the praying press?
Yes, very much, very much. And again, I think that's a good example of this kind of Reformation is, and they, of course, the Catholics saw, you know, the popular movement and so on. And so there's a great emphasis then to do the same thing, to get, you know, written materials out there, all, of course, approved and centralized by the authorities, but absolutely. And, you know, of course, Latin remains the universal language of the liturgy and the clergy and the literate classes, but, you know, at the popular level, the first catechisms, the first Catholic catechisms are fascinating to read because they are following Luther's small catechism almost, point for point, only making sure that they get the other side of things. So absolutely, that's right.
And they were written in the local language.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And there's a real effort to evangelize lay folks and to teach them, but within this understanding of things, which, of course, again, has a great emphasis upon the hierarchy and the true teachings of the church and so on. And the emphasis, I think, for lay people, it's fair to say, I think I can say this unpolemically, is that the things you need to do to be and live as a good, proper, right Catholic and obtain salvation. Here it is. And it's pretty clear cut. It's pretty firm. There's something wonderful about having that kind of clarity and sharpness and, you know, here's the deal. And if you follow this, you're on the right path. Yeah.
Correct me, maybe I don't know enough. This is a dumb question, but I thought the printing press, the Protestants also published the Bible, didn't they, in local languages?
Oh, absolutely, but right. Luther's German translation.
Okay, but then you said they printed in local languages,
sure,
the catechisms, but did they print in local languages the Bible?
Yes, absolutely. The Bible was printed in all the major languages of Europe. Now, again, obviously, it didn't have the same kind of emphasis within Catholic tradition.
Can you explain that just a little bit?
Well, because, again, this notion of where authority comes from and how the meanings of the faith are conveyed, you know, beginning with Luther, said his understanding of what Catholicism was, and I'll call it that at the time. He wasn't saying, I'm defining Lutheranism. In fact, he said a lot of times that, you know, people, if they want to start using that name, they're just way off base. but because then the idea, and he emphasized very much that every Christian ought to learn at least the basics of the Bible. So early on, it had that kind of emphasis.
When they went to their services, the Lutherans might describe and discuss the Bible in German. And they,
sure, absolutely, right.
In the Catholic Church, yeah. Are they doing that as well?
Well, again,
still stayed,
yeah,
flat.
Yeah, again, the role of Scripture in worship, for example, mm-hmm, still would have been different. I mean, there would have been the use of a scriptural text and so on, but the Mass and the Eucharist was still overwhelmingly the center of worship.
That would have been in Latin, right?
Right, in Latin. And of course, the way that the Mass was conducted, the Mass was not understood to be something that the people are really participating in by witnessing the Mass, which is understood in somewhat different theological terms than Luther did too. Now, you know, I think, again, speaking of, you can think about Lutherans as, you know, a 500-year-old community of excommunicated Catholics. And one of the ways in which Lutheranism stays closer to Catholicism is, I think people have always heard the phrase, word and sacrament, right? So Luther always said, and all his followers said, we're only taking away those things of the historic church and the tradition of the church that are contrary to what we understand to be the essentials. But absolutely everything else in tradition and worship and so on should continue, the universal church. So that's why still in almost all Lutheran churches I know, the altar is still right there, right? In the center. And the Eucharist is still a part of the worship, very much. And the means of grace, at least I learned long ago, are word and sacraments, sacrament with the word, and so on, which, again, as Protestantism changed, a lot of Protestants, that second part didn't quite hold up as much, and the emphasis became more on, you know, Bible alone or word alone, and this, yeah.
Did Luther die thinking he was a Catholic?
Well, yeah, in some respects, of course. I mean, he knew, he still, for example, I used to assign my students Luther's commentary on the Magnificat. You know, he commented on all parts of the Bible. And his commentary on the Magnificat is this immense praise of Mary, and just done in this incredible language. And the students would go, well, he just couldn't get that out of his system, obviously. He was still so infused with that. So, I mean, in many respects, he still understood. But, of course, it was pretty hard when you had a sentence of death against you, and you know the papacy and everything else was saying that you were a heretic and a criminal and an outlaw. I mean, it was, you know, he recognized that the folks who were coming with him, it was turning into. 1542, which was 3 years before Luther died, was the last major, really serious attempt. And there were some very brilliant people that tried to say, can we yet compromise? Even if we disagree on some of these things, can't we stay on a center? And, you know, they got fairly close, and then one key bishop died, and that was it. So by the end, it was pretty obvious where things were going in that regard. But I think it's in a way, given the modern ecumenical movement, it's interesting to think about that, you know, in a way. And part of what I would say, a little bit, is that, you know, it sort of has taken, let's say, 400 and some years for that conversation to resume. And in many respects, really, what Vatican II is, it's a lot of other things, but it's a kind of delayed reaction to the Reformation. It takes a long time. I mean, Catholicism is a big church, 1.2 billion people. And, you know, Vatican II, in many respects, is that church coming to terms in a more positive way, I think, to Luther's and of course, the others' conversations. Not necessarily directly. And you won't find any mention of that in Vatican II. But in many respects, it represents the positive response and openness to some of these exchanges that for 400 years was shut down just because of the way things developed. Okay, well, maybe I'll just say a few words very quickly about the church in the centuries in between here, and the two things just to mention. One is that, of course, in the 18th century in Europe particularly, you had the movements after the wars of religion, which alienated many people, and that's a sort of separate chapter. Many people, particularly writers and thinkers and intellectuals, began saying, look, you know, the whole business of religion creates bigots, you know, fanaticism, craziness. The whole doctrine about where truth comes from, revelation or Bible, are both equally, you know, unproven. Let's turn to reason and science and open our minds. Religion's fine insofar as it supports morality and a decent life. But let's not get all this other stuff in here, much less, you know, sacrifices and miracles and all that. So, and then, of course, the church also, as part of that reaction to the Reformation, had really aligned itself with the traditional social order and hierarchy of Europe. The kings and the nobles, and so it really became a reactionary social force. It used its power, and it was upheld by the traditional authorities. And so many of the movements that began developing of, you know, opening to the modern world, new scientific and cultural and so on ideas, the church tended to stand hostile to in that era. That's way oversimplified, but we'll do it for the moment. And then all that exploded in the French Revolution, 1789. And originally, again, the French Revolution was a kind of reforming movement, but it eventually became extremely radical, heavily atheistic, materialistic, absolutely hostile to all forms of Christianity, really. And so that was a kind of second trauma for Catholicism, especially in France, because France was a very important, obviously, Catholic country. The oldest daughter of the church was France, understanding of France. And so then in the 19th and into the 20th century, the Catholic Church really became linked to these anti-modern developments in all spheres. Again, that's an oversimplified story, but basically true. So that many of the movements that develop in the 19th century are explicitly designed to shelter the church against these horrible forces of materialism and atheism. And then you get the dominant perspective that many Catholic writers had in the 19th and 20th centuries is, you know, this shows you, once the authority of the church is undermined, first you get Protestantism, which is individual subjectivity, and then you get atheism, revolution, social destruction, you know, the undermining of all morality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this in a sense, made the church even more defensive against the modern world. And in 1864, Pope Pius IX issued a document called the Syllabus of Errors, and one of the errors he outlined was that the church should ever reconcile itself to democracy, progress, and modern civilization. The church must always stand against those three forces. Democracy, progress, and modern civilization. They're explicitly condemned as universal errors. People have forgotten a lot of this, but that was very much the case. Yeah?
The I don't know much about the Great Schism in about 1000.
Yeah.
Was that a peaceful split, or is it as violent as the... Reformation.
Yeah, no, there was no warfare or anything like that, but you know there was a lot of shall we say verbal warfare, and basically the patriarch of what was Constantinople at the time and the pope at the time excommunicated one another. Okay, so they each sent letters saying you aren't a legitimate Christian, and the patriarch of Constantinople said you aren't either. and so, so you know, it was verbal warfare, but there was always a different relationship there, even when they split, because they always recognized that those churches, the historic ones, were Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, Constantinople, and Rome. The other four churches were understood to be the most ancient churches of Christ, going back to the first centuries. So, and of course, part of Vatican II, by the way, we know that the attempts to, you know, introduce interreligious dialogue with Protestants and others, but really a strong part of the motivation was also reinstituting dialogue with the Eastern Orthodox churches. And the bishops of Rome, the popes, have always had this special sense like, that was really bad that we are at odds with them. I mean, you know, the Western... heretics or schismatics are one thing, but I mean it's very bad that we are at odds, and of course there's been a vast reconciliation on that score.
Was there?
Yeah.
I was not known enough about French Catholicism and Gallic.
Yeah.
That there had been in the 16th and 17th centuries this notion of France as not quite a national church,
right?
But somewhat different from Rome,
right? Right.
So the Great Schism is the, you know, the Roman, the Italian Pope and the French Pope, and how did that?
Well, that was actually back in the Middle Ages. Yeah. There was the one Pope set himself up in Avignon in France, but it was true that you know, to some degree, French Catholics had, you know, there's a sort of a sense of national difference from the papacy and so on. Although, again, in the 16th and 17th centuries, French Catholicism, I said the Spanish, but there was also French Catholicism became a very strong and forceful church, absolutely. And many of them, you know, they became, the French Jesuits became missionaries all over the globe. Okay, well, then I'm just going to leap up to Vatican II, which is, we'll make everyone feel better after this story, I think, of polemics and, you know, hostilities and so on. And I'm leaving aside the story, of course, of Protestant understandings of Catholicism through these centuries, figuring that people can kind of intuit that or remember what their grandparents thought of Catholics or things like that. But, of course, the changes of the 20th century... impacted the church, the modern world in Europe. I've also left aside talking about the growth of American Catholicism over here, which is itself a great and fascinating story, unusual story, because in Europe one of the great worries was that the working class was leaving the church, and that was part of the emphasis in Catholicism when I start talking about Catholic social thought. In America, the overwhelming number of Catholics here were immigrants, essentially first Irish and German, mostly working class or farmers, and then, of course, followed in the late 19th century by Italians and Poles and Lithuanians and others and so on. So actually, keeping the working class attached to the church was never a problem in American Catholicism. The church was basically a working class church, and deep devotion to the bishops and the papacy and everything else for a very long time. But this sense of the church in this militant defensive posture had already been opening before the middle of the 20th century, and really you can trace a lot of things, and I'll be talking on the Catholic social thought element in the other sessions, but when Pope Pius XII, who was the last, very traditionalist pope, died in 1958, everyone expected that another sort of traditionalist would be elected. But instead, and there was controversy among different candidates for the papacy, and so instead they settled on this compromise, who was, I think he was 73 years old, the cardinal of the Patriarch of Venice, Angelo Roncalli, so he was going to be just a temporary caretaker, roly-poly man, and he came in 1958 and just changed everything. I mean, really, within a year, he was not a caretaker at all. And he had observed all these developments for a long time. He was a peasant by background, so he was not the traditional kind of person who was educated through the diplomatic service and all that. And so he announced in 1959 that he was going to call an ecumenical council in 1962, and the phrase he used was aggiornamento, updating. And the other statement that he issued in the first call was, we're going to throw open the windows of the church and let some fresh air in. and really then, that was the first ecumenical, the Vatican Council I was 1870, which was the one that declared the infallibility of the Pope on matters of where he defines himself speaking ex cathedra as doctrinal. But so it was only the second ecumenical council since the Council of Trent. So there for the first time since 1870 and the second time since before, all the bishops of the world come together at the ecumenical council. And he also then invited observers and input from all the other churches too. And so, I mean, the atmosphere of the Second Vatican Council, as I said, was one of coming to terms with the Reformation and also engaging the modern world in very transformative ways. And I'm just going to rattle off quickly some of the changes there, and then maybe we can throw it open for some more questions. The key document was called Gaudium et Spes, the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. And it basically, sort of redefined the understanding of what the church is. It still says, the church is the church, the body of Christ, the essential component of, what Jesus left us on earth and so on. But now, instead of a perfect hierarchical society, it is the people of God. That it begins by saying that right away. And secondly, it says that the church is not a kind of exclusive club for the salvation of its members. It instead exists in solidarity with all human beings. The joys and sorrows, the hopes and fears of all human beings, especially those of the poor and marginal, are those of the Church of Christ. That's the opening sentence of that document. And for many Catholics still, and especially those who like Reformed Catholicism, that sentence is one that you memorize and repeat every week. And it's very, very important to the, and all the other changes that went along with that, the ones that people remember, I suppose, are the liturgical reforms, right? Within about after these documents were issued, then in about a 3-week period, the Latin Mass was ended, and the vernacular liturgy was celebrated all around the world in 400 different languages. The priest, instead of facing the altar and turned with his back to the people and performing the acts of the Mass, was turned around and faced the people, and so on. And there were many other changes, biblical studies, which again had begun earlier, but there was always a suspicion of biblical studies, certainly modern biblical studies. Now, go to it, Catholic scholars, get as good as the Protestants at biblical studies. Many of the penitential disciplines that had been defined for a very long time, which many people probably still hold in memory, like the meat fast on Fridays and the notion that you fast before Eucharist, were made optional, essentially. You can still do them, they're good penitential practices, but you don't have to do them, which is actually a good Lutheran statement, too. You know, Luther always says, all penitential practices are great as disciplines, if you choose to do them. Just no rules, no rules to that effect. Ecumenical relations, already mentioned. Let's form, conversations about absolutely every matter. So you have, you know, Catholic Lutheran, Catholic Orthodox, Catholic Methodist, Catholic Baptist dialogues. And some of these are quite marvelous, by the way, if you ever read, I think the Lutheran Catholic dialogue ran to 12 volumes before they quit. And it's really quite exciting. Religious liberty. This was one where the Americans actually took the lead at Vatican II, because the traditional statement was that the right way for society was to be organized was with the Catholic Church as the legitimate church, the church, and all others to be prohibited. Now, they always said, where you have to make accommodations, okay. But if and when, you know, the ideal is always that we will restore a universal church sponsored by the state. And of course, the Americans hadn't been into this for a very long time. They didn't. The Catholic Church here had thrived, and most American Catholics couldn't imagine ever having, you know, a Catholic state church in the United States, even though that's what the Protestants were always fearing with Al Smith, and then by the time John Kennedy got elected, everybody saw that was a bugaboo, and so that was gone. But that was one of the great documents of Vatican II, to say we don't need government support anymore, and religious liberty is the ideal state. Let the church thrive without support, sponsorship, control by the state. So those are some of the major ones. Now, an interesting question that's happened since then, and I'll just summarize this very briefly, and then maybe people will ask questions, is, was Vatican II really a repudiation of what went before, or is it understood to be a development of what went before? For many, you know, sort of, I'll call them, for want of a better term, modern Catholics or progressive Catholics or liberal Catholics, this was a kind of statement that the church is really a new church, a kind of fresh church. We're starting from scratch, and all everything that went on before was really bad, and we're throwing it out. While other Catholics, began saying, wait a minute, yes, this is all good. We agree with this, but let's not get carried away here. Some of the changes here, as they start getting carried on, are really going to undermine the core of the church. And, if we're not careful, we're going to lose what is the valuable elements of Catholicism. And so, in some respects, the dialogue, especially after 1968, when Pope Paul VI issued Humanae Generis, which is the papal encyclical on birth control. Many people had expected that he would, he had a commission that was going to say birth control is just fine, and they argued back and forth a long time, and then the document said, no, it really isn't. We're sticking with the traditional doctrine on that score. And even though they issued, Pope Paul VI issued these wonderful documents, like another encyclical called Populorum Progressi, which says basically, that's the encyclical that talks about the church in solidarity with the poor. Many people may be aware of that. But then, there began this debate about how far should these changes go. And many Catholics became anxious then, as, the expectations that there would be a wonderful flourishing and revival of the church under the reforms of Vatican II, in many respects, were fulfilled. I mean, many people became involved, the laity became involved, the ministry opportunities expanded, the church opened up to all kinds of people in the third world and elsewhere. On the other hand, there were disturbing developments, like what? Many priests abandoning their vocations. many, many people clamoring for further changes yet. Let's have a married priesthood. Let's have the ordination of women. Let's go further. Let's get rid of bishops and cardinals. And, you know, papal authority is another leftover from the Middle Ages that we can do without, and so on and so on. So there's been a kind of dialogue, I think, ever since then. And, of course, you know, 1978, the first non-Italian pope since 1512 was elected, Cardinal Wojtyla, John Paul II. And he, in a way, is an interesting figure in this regard, of course, because on one hand, he was president of Vatican II, was one of the reforming bishops of Krakow at Vatican II. On the other hand, he's one who said, you know, sort of like, okay, you know, enough is enough here. Let's stop and reconsider this, and you know, look at these questions of authority and again. And so there's been a kind of very interesting dialogue on all those questions and with others. So I will stop here and invite more questions, comments.
I'm curious about, my sense is that it's more than a dialogue. That yeah. That there's a deepening
division,
rift,
yeah.
Division within the church. Among those who really, including the hierarchy now,
right.
Who want to pull back,
right.
And the progressives,
right.
Who want to go forward. And,
yeah.
I mean, do you agree with that? Where,
yeah.
Do, where
yeah.
do you see that going?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, really, when you get right down to it, and in the last years, I mean, the last 15 years, you know, one of the things John Paul II did was appoint bishops who were more, you know, traditionalists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what many Catholics felt is that we're not, these reform movements are weakening the church. They are turning it into the same kind of subjectivism. And in fact, people are just going away from the church. And I mean, there's some interesting dialogues. Cardinal George in Chicago had a great meeting with all the liberal Catholic groups there. And he said, how many of your children are serious, faithful, devoted, church-going Catholics? And only a handful of hands went up. And he said, see, you can't even pass the faith on to your own children. So I think it's a difficult tension. You know, and obviously some polemics too, of course. You know, some people leave the Catholic Church. Where it will go, I honestly don't know. I mean, who can know where that will go? I do think that, and one of the things I would say for Lutherans particularly, is that the emphasis on unity in the Catholic Church is very strong. That is, no matter how deep the divisions get and how bitter they get, the one thing, let's put it this way, the one thing most Catholics won't think of doing is starting a new church. I mean, you know, that's usually the Protestant solution. If the divisions get too great, you just form your own church. Why not? You know, and so, you know, I'm always impressed by Catholics can be at bitter, bitter odds. But you say, well, are you ready to start a new church? No, we would never do that. So I think you can have a lot of that. But obviously, many people have become discontented, alienated, distanced, and so on.
Yeah,
and some have gone over to other denominations, too.
Well, and I think on both sides of it. I mean, the progressive Catholics are feeling that what we came to expect,
right.
is
hasn't
not happening. And the more traditional Catholics are also, it's not moving back fast enough,
right.
into the,
right.
the
right.
traditional mode.
Right, right. That's a good description. In the back and then...
I was wondering if Vatican has something to say about science and religion as well, because
yeah.
that, of course, was the big,
yeah.
you know, sort of tension from the 18th century.
In that Enlightenment business and so on.
Right.
Yeah, 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 and very much also, when I said biblical studies, I should have said also science as well. You know, this was, I think, about 15 years ago that... I think this was still under Pope John Paul II. They lifted the official condemnation of Galileo, really, there's been a very much a, you know, statement to say, go full bore to science, openness to science. There can be no contradiction between Catholic truth and scientific truth. You have a lot of very smart scientific advisors to the Vatican and so on. Now, you know, there are some people there that still have trouble with things like evolution and so on. But basically, that debate is pretty much over. And there's an example of where, you know, that kind of an issue wouldn't divide conservative and progressive Catholics at all. Overwhelmingly, they support, you know, and there's a lot of very terrific Catholic scientists these days. Yeah.
Well, the tension between sort of unity and purity and ecumenicalism
right.
in regards to the communion practice within the Catholic
right.
Church,
right.
the closed communion,
right.
Is that continue to be a tension now as a historical precedent for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of where do you think that's going?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the practice has always been, and the teaching has always been, that participation in the Eucharist is a reflection of participation in the body of Christ, and that it's a confession of faith, and so that if you, you know, only faithful Catholics under ordinary circumstances ought to commune at Catholic tables, and that was the defining moment. Now, it's always been understood that there's discretion to bishops and to local priests for various circumstances for that kind of thing. And again, you don't have to go very far to find Catholic parishes where it's essentially open communion. But there's an example of where some people are saying, well, where does this end? And does the Eucharist have the same meaning if anybody who believes whatever can come in and so on? So it's an issue. I should have also mentioned here, some people may know the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification, 1999, JDDF, which came out of the Lutheran Catholic Dialogues. And there was a case, too, where the theologians labored for, a dozen years to come up with this document that was going to supposedly finally end the faith works issue and define in this very careful language how we can get together on that. So they issued this document, and then people on both sides started taking pot shots at it. You compromise too much, and so on and so on. So,
I have a question.
Yeah.
Up here.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how to ask it. Much of what you've said is really a reaction against the existing structures, the existing practices among the governmental units of the churches. Are the church, and so I'm concerned about what's happening today. You have with the doubling of knowledge, just accelerating.
Right.
The different kinds of things that are happening in society, the societal issues, the globalization of the world.
Right.
Let's not even say Catholic, Lutheran, etc.
Yeah.
Is the religious organizational structure strong enough to withstand what's happening in terms of maintaining even the existing believers?
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's a very large question. One of the things I haven't mentioned here, of course, is the tremendous explosion of Catholicism in general and Christianity generally in the Third World. I guess I put this up here. Third World Catholicism. By now, there's 1.2 billion Catholics worldwide, and something like two-thirds of those are in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So in many respects, Catholicism and Christianity generally is more global than it's ever been. A lot of people, I think, here at Holden Village and other places have talked about, we in North America, or certainly in Europe, we're starting to be a different, a smaller proportion of the universal church. And in many respects, the modern popes, by the way, have started sort of saying, well, Europe's in bad shape, and where's North America going? The future of the church is in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. So there's a great emphasis on that. Now, how that, in many parts of the world, the church, again, Catholic and Protestant, is, as you say, competing with other ideologies and all the massive issues of poverty and development and, social justice and welfare and technology and you know, how people are understanding their lives. On the other hand, I mean, I guess I'm one who would say that Christianity and Catholic Christianity and Lutheran Christianity are tremendous resources as well for people in those places, you know, and I have a friend who travels a great deal to these places and said, you know, if you could see the fervor of believers in places like Thailand, you know, they have, you think you've walked into a meeting of first century Christians, you know, it's sort of like, holy smokes, they're just on fire with the Holy Spirit and, you know, Jesus is as present as he was, you know, and so there's this sense, and of course, some people have started talking about this, and there are some instances of churches in the third world sending missionaries to North America. things have gotten kind of lax here. People have lost their sense of, you know, whatever. And actually, for the priest shortage, it's a small movement, but there are places in the American church where they've priests have come from Africa and the Philippines, particularly, and so. One way of addressing the priest shortage is because they're producing priests like mad, you know, and we tend to forget about that here. I don't know if that answers the question. Yeah.
Well, that would never work because we've only got one language.
Yeah, good question. Good question. Yeah.
I just want you to help clear something up. You mentioned that Pope Pius the 12th.
Right.
Those are three things that he announced that. Kind of, if you could just say what they were again, and then that's one question. The other one, if I'm correctly, then all comes this Pope John.
Right.
It's kind of this nondescript.
Right.
Jelly. And actually, when you said that, I remember back, oh, John Paul, he looks like Jabba the Hutt.
John the 23rd,
you mean? Yeah, John. Okay, John, so, I'm, yep. So anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But you mentioned that he was just sort of looked upon as a transitory.
Right, right.
Aren't the cardinals the one who elected
him? Yes, right.
Didn't the cardinals have a clue that this guy
was? Not one. Not a clue at all. Not a clue. And there are actually documents where they say, you know, fortunately we've got an odd entity who won't live long. And, no, they didn't get it at all. I mean, it was kind of like...
they didn't get it.
No.
And the only salvation is, my God, God will take him soon.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that's fine. Okay. I mean, well, he was going to be just a kind of transitional figure while we figure out somebody
else. So they were
totally
surprised.
Right. And of course, you know, there and you can always say the Holy Spirit tricks every time, you know, just when you think.
How do you hear Gregory doing now? What Gregory now? You feel he's maintaining.
You mean the Benedict? Pope Benedict?
The last new one.
Yeah, Benedict the 16th. Yeah. Yes. Well, boy, you're putting me on the spot here. Benedict, you know, was, I should say, he was the Cardinal Ratzinger, who was the head of the Holy Office, which was formally changed its name from the Inquisition. Yeah. So he was sort of the doctrinal enforcer there, and most of the liberal and progressive Catholics were extremely worried when he came in, that he had the reputation of, you know, cracking the whip pretty strong. You know, he's. I think many people have been surprised by how personally amenable he is, and you know how gentle he has been on the whole. On the same time, he's made some real stumbles too.
Yeah.
And
like
well, the examples are that he reinstated. There was this. I haven't mentioned there was a conservative breakoff after Vatican II. There was a group of one bishop and then a bunch of priests who said that John Paul XXIII was an illegitimate pope. You can't do this. You can't alter Latin and so on. So he must have been a fake. And so they broke away. Pope Benedict has invited one of those bishops back in, and it was discovered that he was a Holocaust denier, this guy, this priest. And so that set off, you know, all the efforts that's been made at Catholic-Jewish relations. I haven't talked about that, but, you know, those were just stumbles. And then the same thing with the Islamic relations. In a speech in Munich, I think, he quoted a medieval emperor who said that Islam was a fanatical and dangerous religion. Now, he didn't say it, but he quoted some earlier person. And of course, that actually set off riots in parts of the Islamic world. So, you know, he for someone who's been around so long, you'd think he would be a little more savvy about diplomacy, but how he's going to be regarded, you know, who knows.
Could you comment on the investigation of the U.S. women religious that they've just...
Well, yeah, there have been, you know, issues about, again, how much in order these different the orders have to be and so on. And I think there is one of the commissions that's supposed to be looking into this and so on. You know, my own view is that a lot of those things are really meant to kind of send signals, but there won't be some, you know, harsh crackdown or something like that, I don't think. But it is true that, you know, in Rome and in the American hierarchy, the kinds of things about, for example, I think the dialogue about a married priesthood was really active about 15 years ago in this country. I mean, a lot of people and a lot of bishops at least, you know, saying this can be discussed. And by the way, the married priesthood is just a discipline of the church. Everybody knows that. It was set up around 1000 AD. Even Catholicism says that was just a discipline. So that could be altered at any moment. But now I think that's pretty much a dead letter again.
Yeah.
I don't think you will find in official circles that being discussed, which frustrates many people, as does
even though there are the married priests who came in from other
traditions,
they make a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I don't know if you know that. Well, first of all, there are the Eastern priests. There's a set of churches that are affiliated with Rome that are Eastern, and they have married clergy. So they're in full communion with the Bishop of Rome, but they have a married clergy. And then John Paul II actually instituted a practice whereby either Lutheran or Episcopalian pastors who decide to come into Catholicism can remain married. So you can meet a married Catholic priest, not one of these Orthodox folks, and they will be either ex-Lutherans or ex-Episcopalians. So, yeah.
In the city of Seattle over in the last decade, there every 3 years has been a gathering of 1,000 Catholic women, led by women religious, pushing the edges.
Right.
And you really have a feeling when you attend one of these gatherings that these women are not going away.
Uh-huh.
So there are these movements, I think, up from the bottom.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting debate. Yeah, sure. I think we can take one or two more questions, and then I'm happy to break it off. Yeah.
One of the present Pope's statements that hasn't gotten much press, but this is about a year ago, he stated that, in effect, the Roman Catholic Church is the church with the full means of salvation.
Right.
Implying that all the others
don't
quite have it together, all the resources there. My friends in the Waldensian Church in Italy say that just set their conversations back 75 years.
Right. And that was closer to the traditional statement I mentioned. And the phrase that was used in the follow-up of Vatican II was the separated brethren. Okay, so the Protestant churches are the separated brethren, and they were defined as ecclesial communities. You couldn't use the word church. But that recent document, whose name now slips my mind, was a little bit of a return to the notion that, you know, they may be good folks, they may be Christians, and so on, but they don't have church. Whatever they're doing is something else. So... yeah, that was widely regarded as a kind of setback in that regard. One more? Is there one more? Yeah.
One question. Somebody? When you were talking about, Romero is another example of someone that they didn't think was going to have much of an impact.
Right.
And then boom.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, Archbishop Romero in Latin America, is a great martyr in many respects. Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate it, and I'm glad to talk with anybody individually or in group terms, and so on. I hope this is worthwhile and